What I love about When Dating Hurts is when I pick up my 14-year-old daughter from school, I can put an episode on and sit there and it explains the warning signs of what domestic violence is. Obviously, she's coming to an age where she's getting older, and this is the most invaluable advice that she can receive. And from someone that has experienced such a hard and traumatic loss, thank you, Bill. I really appreciate everything you do.
The When Dating Hurts podcast continues to grow in popularity. The more who listen, the more who will know the realities of dating and domestic violence. In the meantime, the When Dating Hurts book, in paperback, ebook, and audiobook, is being purchased and read by concerned parents, teachers, victims and survivors, and of course, those who are currently dating. Education leads to empowerment. That way, if a potential abuser is targeting you or someone you care about, you will know how to detect it and how to break free and stay safe. Up next, another survivor story to illustrate how an innocent person can become manipulated and trapped in abusive relationships. This episode comes with trigger warnings for its content and for its graphic descriptions. Claire lowers herself into a codependency with her toxic, abusive boyfriend. He is violent, to say the least, and he delivers blows to Claire's face that are despicable, and then finds ways to turn the blame on her. Throughout this entire story, we find it difficult to see how she could love a man who repeatedly does this to her. But intimate partner violence is not a subject that follows an outsider's logic. Her abuser blames her for the mistreatment, and later on, she sees through what had happened, him actually blaming her for the punishments. We now return to Claire's story, part two, which includes the abuse coming to an end one horrible evening.
There should be no reason to rush anything, but if someone has bad intentions, it could be a way of like creating this codependency very early on. I think that's probably another thing to look out for with those kinds of people.
In this case, you got somebody who's 50% older than you.
Yeah.
That's a lot of experience, especially when it's those years, you know, when it's, you know, when he's got the roughly, let's say 22 to 35 or whatever it adds up to, you know, those are a lot of practice. He's been on the practice field quite a lot more than you have, especially with your upbringing with one-on-ones with teachers and things like that. You know, it's not like you've been socializing like crazy. And in the meantime, this guy's out there working the field. You know, he knows everything.
Yeah.
He comes into it. He's quite a veteran by the time he meets up with Claire.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that last incident, my parents and my grandma had come over for dinner, and my ex made dinner for my family and me. And we had like a really nice time together. My family really liked him. He's always seemed to get along with everybody, and he was a really good cook. So I just remembered everyone having a really nice time. And there was a moment in the night where my mom and my grandma and I were together in the living room, and then my ex was in the kitchen with my dad, and they were talking. And I obviously I didn't know what they were talking about. You know, at the end of the night, we walked my parents to their car, said goodnight, and then came back inside the apartment. I thought everything went really well. I was in a good mood. He seemed like he was in a good mood until we got back in the apartment. And my ex, I was like in the bathroom, and he tells me that he was talking to my dad, and that my dad mentioned something to him about one of the reasons why I was sent to boarding school in Mexico. And there was many reasons that I was sent to this boarding school. It wasn't like one thing, but there was one incident that was the final like catalyst to me being sent away. And it's like when I was 13 years old, I had messaged an older man on the internet. Again, I never met this person. And in fact, the only reason my parents ever found out about it was because I had lied to this guy about my age. And at a certain point in us communicating, he reveals to me that he actually knew how old I was the whole time, because he had like looked my name up And he started to send me like inappropriate messages and videos that made me feel really uncomfortable. And I ended up calling the non-emergency hotline for the city that he lived in because I felt very weird about it. And again, like I told you, I was on all of these meds. So I think I was acting a little bit erratic. I thought I was going to be able to call this hotline and just be like, hey, I think this guy's a pedophile. Like, bye. Like, you guys figure this out. And of course, that's not what happened. They ended up contacting my parents. They brought me to the police station for questioning. I was sent to this boarding school in Mexico, and he was running a ballet studio, and he actually had been like molesting multiple girls. He was arrested and sent to prison. Luckily, I never met up with this man, but like, again, that was the only reason that my parents even found out about it. So regardless, I have no idea really why this came up. I think maybe my ex said that he had also been sent to a boarding school in Mexico when he was a teenager, but he's also a pathological liar. So I'm not sure if that was really true or not. And from what he said, he was talking to my dad about how much he loved me and how good I was for him. And like one of the reasons that we had bonded and felt so connected to each other was because we shared the similar experience. And then my dad was like, oh, well, you know why she was sent away, right? And then he tells him that. So my ex questions me about that and says, is this true? You know, I thought you were sent away because you had an eating disorder and whatever. Like I said, it was more than one thing. And I was like, well, yeah, but again, like it wasn't just that. And he got super angry. And mind you, he had been drinking whiskey with my dad. So he was already like drunk. He starts to get angry and he was like, I knew it. It was only a matter of time before another lie came up. And he started to, he like punched me in the face, I think once. And then he ran and grabbed garbage bags, started to bag up my clothing and threw trash bags of my clothing outside of our window. And we live on the third story of this apartment.
So he's grabbing all kinds of clothing, like symbolically, I'm throwing you out is the idea.
Yeah, exactly. He was like clearing out the dresser. He grabbed my makeup mirror and some stuff from my vanity and threw that all on the street. Mm-hmm. And then he's telling me like, we're done, get out, like just get out. And I just quickly grabbed my bag and I ran downstairs and I started to pick up my clothing off the street and like put them back in the trash bag. And I'm panicking. I'm like, I don't know what to do because I'm like, I don't want to be here, but like, how do I call my parents? We just had this beautiful dinner. They might have only been 10 minutes away, but like, how could I call them and say that? You know, it's like, I've been working so hard to like, you know, they all thought I was moving too fast. There's a lot of things that I did that they probably didn't think was a smart decision. And I was trying so hard to prove to them, again, probably not conscious of this at the time, but I was trying to like prove to them, like, I can handle myself. Like, look, this person wants to be with me. You know, we're happy and like, I can handle myself on my own. And like, I'm an adult and like, I can, you know, I have a different job now and I live in this apartment and things are going well. And it was like, I felt like I had to uphold this image, but also I was in love with my ex. Like, I didn't want to leave him. I just didn't want him to continue to hurt me. There was no way for me to call my parents and tell them what happened after this beautiful dinner, because I knew once I said that, I couldn't be with him. I just knew there was no way that we would be able to stay together. And I wasn't ready to make that call. I didn't have any other friends of mine. All my close friends lived in Southern California, so they weren't close by. The only other person that I knew in our area was his brother. But again, I can't go to his brother's house even to be safe, because I know that any variable that I couldn't account for terrified me. Because I knew, like, I just knew that if I like hung around while he was like abusive, eventually he would get tired, he would fall asleep, and like the next day would be fine. But mm-hmm. I've never experienced like leaving in the middle of him being angry. And I was really scared that if I were to have left in the middle of a fight, that when I got back, all of my belongings would have been destroyed. He would have become more violent. He would have become more paranoid. Like, who did you talk to? Who did you text? Like, he's already broken my phone once before. I'm sure he would have done it again. There's no way for me to go to his brother's house and say why I'm there without it getting back to my ex. So I just felt trapped. I knocked on my old roommate's door, but she didn't answer. So I remember I grabbed my things and I'm sitting on the steps trying to figure out what I'm going to do. And he comes downstairs to get me. And he's upset because he like sees that I have these I'm standing with my trash bags, but I'm kind of near the security camera. So he thinks that I'm trying to like alert our landlord that something's happening. Again, he was like very paranoid. And then he tells me that he got me a hotel room, which isn't true. He never bought me a hotel room. So I don't know why he said that. I think maybe he was just trying to get me to come up the stairs or something, but tells me that I can spend the night, but that by 12 p.m. the next day, I need to go home. So I follow him upstairs. And as soon as we get in the apartment, he starts to be violent again. And at that point, I'm like, I try to leave, but he grabs me and he grabs me with one arm and he begins to slam the front door repeatedly on my body, grabs me inside, throws the front door shut and then locks it. And then he just starts punching me repeatedly in the face. I drop down to my knees and I'm like covering my face with my arms. And he starts like kicking me and kneeing me. He then drags me to our bedroom and starts, he grabs me by, I'm on my knees. He grabs me by the back of my head and starts like slamming my face repeatedly into our doorway. And then he hooks his middle and index finger on both sides of my mouth and like pulls my mouth open as hard as possible and says, I'm going to rip your fucking mouth open. And then he drags me from our bedroom to the living room, which is the furthest room from the front door. It's a 3-bedroom apartment. He strangles me on our couch. He's standing over me. I'm beneath him on the couch. And I can't breathe. Like, he's so much bigger than me. He's standing over me. He has both hands around my neck. I finally managed to, like, push him away enough so that I can get away. And at this point, he's like, so who was this guy, huh? How did you meet him? Like, he's asking me questions about... God, like, I need to go. Like, he was scaring me because it's like that jealousy. I was terrified. And I'm like, please just let me leave. Please just let me leave. Closes the door to the living room behind him. And he's like, oh, now you want to leave. And he won't move. I remembered running over to our window. And I threw open our window because I was like, I thought I was going to have to jump out of the apartment. Because mm-hmm. He was getting increasingly more angry. He essentially trapped me in there. But as like almost as soon as I open the window, he runs behind me and he slams it shut. But it was in that moment, and I didn't obviously know this at the time, but in that like that split second, there was a car full of girls parked across, not even on our side of the street, but across the street, who somehow, even though their windows were rolled up and they were playing music, they heard me screaming and they saw him like come at me, and they called the police. And at the time, like, I didn't know, but after he slammed the window shut, I can't remember the order of things because my memory is not great, but he like slammed my face into this like marble side table that we had and it sliced my face open. Oh. And he was just continuing to punch me in the face. My blood was sprayed all over the walls, the couch, the floor. My blood was just all over the place, running down my face. My entire face and my hair were just covered in blood. And once he stopped hitting me, he started to cry. And this was something he would do a lot, where he was like, I don't understand why you can't just be honest with me. He's like, I've never lied to you. I have always been good to you. I cooked for your family tonight. Like, you know how much that means to me to cook. And he's just like crying to me. And then he looks at me in my face and says, you deserve this. You know that, right? And like, I could sense something that in him that like, had the police not shown up when they did, I felt like it maybe would have become like a sexual thing for him because his tone, just the way his tone changed. But at this point, after he said, you deserve this, you know that, right? At another point before that, he was like, I am so much better than you. He was just saying like some crazy things. But then he hears sirens and he runs over to the window and then he runs and turns the lights off. And then he grabs the trash bags and he tells me to go sit in the back of the apartment, kind of towards the stairwell to the trash cans. So he puts me out there with the bags and like locks the door. And all I can hear is our doorbell ringing nonstop. Our doorbell is ringing. And that's all I hear for like 2 to like 3 minutes. And I don't know what's happening, but I assume that he's scrambling, trying to clean our apartment. Because I remembered in our hallway seeing a big bloody handprint on the hallway. And later it was gone. So, and also he had taken his shirt off, which was covered in my blood. So I'm sure he was just trying to clean up, but eventually the doorbell stops ringing and I hear a bunch of people enter the apartment. I hear one officer say like, there's a back door. And that's when they opened the door and they found me. And I wouldn't answer any of their questions. I didn't know what was going to happen. Like, my ex was outside. And yeah, they basically like took pictures of me, and I refused to give them really any information about what happened. And then once the EMTs showed up, they made me like look at myself in the mirror because they wanted me to go to the hospital, and I didn't want to leave because I think I still felt that like loyalty to my ex. The EMT was like, you need to go to the hospital because I think you're going to, like, the cut in my head was so deep that he said I was going to get an infection if I didn't get medical attention. So they took me to the emergency room. They had to give me two sets of stitches in my face for the cut. I had a broken eye socket, a broken nose, and a black eye. I had bruising like all over my face, my ears, my neck, my body. And yeah, so they kept me there overnight. And eventually I had to get surgery to correct the damage that he caused to my eye socket. The right side of my face is still numb from that, even though that was like a year or more ago. And that night they took him to jail and they kept him there. Surprisingly, I was really shocked because I've learned a lot about domestic violence and domestic violence in our legal system. And there's a lot of people who never get the justice that they deserve because it's a very tricky thing to prosecute. And there's so many variables, but I got very fortunate that they took my case seriously. They didn't set bail for him. They kept him in jail. And eventually it went to trial and he was convicted and sent to prison last month or 2 months ago.
Thank you for taking us through all that. I know that's not easy at all.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get 6,000 cash, give us each 3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com or wherever fine podcasts are found.
You and I spoke on the phone yesterday, and one of the areas, besides everything, I mean, you speeded up the whole trial and all that, and I appreciate the fact that you did that. You kind of got to the end of it. However, the part that I found appalling talking with you yesterday was how the defense lawyers, the defense team handled you. That's something that's always really bothered me a lot. You know, it's when my daughter was killed, I didn't feel like from the other side, in a lot of other ways too, but I didn't feel like it was about getting to the truth about what happened and then deciding what to do with this guy. It was like one side is trying to give this person the stiffest penalty possible, and the other side's trying to get this person off completely as if it never happened, or if anything, like he's the victim. If you can, just give us a sense of how you were treated by the other side.
It's very unfortunate because our legal system is really not equipped to handle situations that are so black and white. And it's very unfortunate when you're not dealing with a victimless crime. It's a very different story. I completely understand what, you know, you're describing your own experience as. It's the same thing that I felt. My ex's attorney she just painted this narrative of me that was just completely false. She was very dismissive of, like, at one of the hearings very early on after his arrest, I showed up to court and I remembered her saying that the photos that the police had taken of me that night, and my face is like completely covered in blood. It's bad. Like, the photos are bad. She was like, oh, they're just some ugly photos. Doesn't mean anything. At one point, she said that I think in her closing arguments at trial, She claimed that I was proud of what he did to me, that I enjoyed what he did to me. At one point, the prosecutor, in her closing arguments, mentions the surveillance footage in my apartment before the violence really escalated that night. She says, like, look at her body language, like she's scared. And then his attorney responds to that, saying that my body language from that security footage was not the body language of someone who had just been punched in their face repeatedly. One, what does that even mean? You know, and it made me so angry because that night when we come back from seeing my parents, my hair is down. And when I am seen again grabbing my things, my hair is in a bun. And it's like, I already knew that I wasn't lying about anything. But whenever he would become violent with me, I would always tie my hair up because he would rip out so much of my hair when he became violent. So it was like instinctual to like tie my hair up. So it just made me so angry to like have to sit there and have her invalidate what I went through when, like, already in my relationship, I could never say anything to him. Even if, for example, I see him like flirting with another girl in front of me, nope, that's not what was happening. And it would always become something flipped on me. I could never talk about what was bothering me. I could never talk to him about what he was doing to me because it was always my fault. So it's like my experiences with him were constantly invalidated. It took a long time for me to even make sense of what really had happened to me because he was so in my head. And now I'm having to go through this legal process where on paper, it should be very evident what kind of dynamic this was. I was being abused. Like I don't like to use the word victim, but it's like pretty evident that this is domestic violence. This person is a sociopath. Even from the district attorney's office, like the level of violence and abuse was like pretty extreme for what they normally see in domestic violence relationships. But then you get into this legal process and it's like theater. The jury gets to hear both sides and it's up to them to decide what they think is believable or not. And even the judge, I think the prosecutor at one point tried to make a comment to the judge at the sentencing hearing before she gave her sentence, acknowledging like what I had to deal with his attorney and the way that I was treated and the way I was spoken about. And the judge was like, he's entitled to whatever defense they see fit, essentially. There's not even really, there's pretty much no limit to what they're allowed to say. They can say whatever, and ultimately the jury decides.
They can trash you. They can do anything they want. It's just like you say, it's like the game.
But it's like, I haven't really even had the opportunity to heal from this because like I'm having to like now listen to it in a very public setting. It's like public record for all of these strangers to hear. And I don't get to say anything. I just get to sit here and listen to like these fabricated stories being told about me. And you know, the other thing that I'm sure many people can relate to, my ex, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I'm like 100% certain that he's a sociopath. Like he is very charming. He really understands how to mimic normal human emotions and make you feel. Even the prosecutor herself, when she was assigned to this case and she started to listen to his jail calls, she found herself laughing and was like, oh, like she was just very thrown off because the person that he appeared to be with his friends was just so, it seemed so distant from the person that he was accused of all of these crimes that even in the beginning, for her, she was like so confused. But of course, as time went on and the more she started to listen to him, she was like, oh, this guy is like an incredibly dangerous person. But you would never know that when you meet him. And he especially makes women feel at ease. And he had all of these women that were showing up to court that were looking at these photos and these videos. And so many people wrote letters for him begging for leniency and, oh, he's not a bad guy, or this is not who he is. To be fair, like his friends and family never really saw this side of him because he's not a generally violent person. His violence was sexually motivated. So to be fair, like his friends and family would have never been exposed to that version of him.
Sure, of course.
Like he had this army of people that were showing up for him, that were harassing me. His attorney would call me and try to make me feel bad for him. His own family, like one of his brothers accused me of being the reason that like his brother was going to kill himself because he was in jail. It was suddenly like my fault that he was facing life in prison. It was my fault. That's the whole point. Like they kept talking about like how bad jail is and how he needs rehab and, you know, prison isn't going to heal him. And yes, our prison system is terrible. Like, it's, I'm not advocating for the benefits of going to prison, but that's, it's supposed to be there as a deterrent to not do stupid things, you know, just, but it was becoming turned on me. And I was in my head constantly, like, it was this constant back and forth where I it took me probably like a year and a half after his arrest before I put myself first in this situation, because for such a long time, he grew up and had not the best childhood. He went through a lot of stuff himself as a child, and I felt for him. No child deserves to be mistreated or abandoned or neglected or abused, like, period. There's no, like, you know, it logically makes sense why certain people grow up to do certain things when they've been exposed or hurt in certain ways. It doesn't make it okay, but it's like a logical explanation. And it was very hard for me to know how to feel about the potential consequences he was facing, knowing the circumstances he grew up in. And of course, like, I was in love with him. Like, I loved him. Like, I, even though I knew I could never be with him, I didn't want him to suffer. Every decision I made, every email that I wrote, everything that I said, I was constantly like, well, what about him? What about his family? It took me a very long time before I could consider myself first. And I think I took on a lot more weight than I needed to, with like the pressure from his attorney and his family and his friends. I carried a lot of guilt that wasn't mine to carry. And I really struggled with knowing how to feel about what should happen for him. Because initially I was just like, he needs therapy and maybe he needs AA, like, he needs to be sober. But the more that time passed and the more that I was in therapy, the more I understood this man is like actually like a sociopath. Like, he's actually like more dangerous than most people because he blends in so well with society. He's good looking. He's intelligent. He knows how to disarm people, and you don't know that it's happening to you. That is the kind of person you need to be worried about. I saw a video recently. I don't know if you've seen it. It was on Instagram, of this man who was being sentenced and for some violent crime. And when he was hoping the judge would be lenient with him, but he's got so many previous convictions that she gave him a very harsh sentence and like a little bit of attitude when she read the sentence. And he like lunged at her and like attacked the judge, couldn't restrain himself, right?
He jumped up over the bench, didn't
yeah.
he? And landed on it.
Yes. Like, yes. There are some men, or maybe women, but like mostly men, who are violent, who can't control themselves. And it's like indiscriminate. But he's not like that. He looks like a preppy boy. Like, he always had his hair like slicked, wearing sweaters. Like, he looks like such a good boy. Like, he just looks like a human being, like a kind person. And, you know, and it's terrifying because it doesn't make sense.
Sure.
But
sure. Yeah, I mean, he's central casting for boyfriend and you know, fine, upstanding citizen, sort of like Ted Bundy. Yeah, you know,
yes, that is exactly who he reminded me of. And it was so, his ability to manipulate and deceive is like on par with Ted Bundy, because him and his attorney were even able to sway jurors to feel bad for him. And only after the fact did we find out from jurors that were on the case that, okay, so once the criminal trial went on for about 3 months, and my ex was, there was 19, he had 19 charges that the jurors had to deliberate on. And it was eight days of deliberations had gone by, and we still didn't have a verdict, because 19 charges is a lot of charges to talk about. And the jurors were only meeting like Monday through Thursday, and we were about to have like a long weekend because there was a federal holiday. And the judge called all of the jurors in, and she wanted to know what verdicts they had reached already. The jurors had reached like 10 verdicts, and they were all 10 were guilty verdicts. And they read them, and they didn't realize that my ex was going to be sitting in the courtroom when the verdicts are read. And I think for maybe four of the jurors, they had a very hard time dealing with the fact that they had to look at him as those guilty verdicts were read. And when they came back the following week to continue deliberations, what had gone from very kind of, it took a while for them to reach verdicts, not because there was like a question of whether he was guilty or not, but they wanted to make sure they fully understood what was being asked of them. They fully understood the law, and they wanted to make sure they were interpreting everything correctly. But when they went back after that initial verdict reading, the tone changed to, well, she knew how to push his buttons. Why didn't she leave? You know, he's already looking at a lot of time. I don't know if she's fully credible. I don't really think she's the victim in this situation. It became like very victim blaming. It completely changed. And from the initial completely unanimous guilty verdicts, they were not able to reach any more verdicts after that. And so that's why instead of 19 convictions, there was 10 convictions. The day the verdicts were finalized, his attorney went out for drinks with like the majority of the jurors. And she told all of them, well, because you guys convicted him of torture, because he was convicted of like multiple counts of domestic violence, assault with a deadly weapon, assault resulting in great bodily injury, false imprisonment, like all of these felony charges, but he was convicted of torture. And the torture charge was the conviction that carries the life sentence. And she told all of them, because you guys convicted him of torture, he's going to be facing life in prison. And she got three jurors. She handed them her business card, bought them drinks, and urged whoever felt badly for him to write a message or to write letters to the judge asking for leniency. And so three of them wrote multiple letters to the judge saying, you know, I don't think he's a bad person. He's not a monster. There's way worse people out there, but I don't think he's one of them. What he did was bad, but not like that bad, you know. And even like at sentencing, his attorney tried to argue that even though he was convicted of torture, what he did to me in comparison to other people who had been convicted of torture wasn't as bad. She literally was like, other people experienced way worse, so he shouldn't be facing a life sentence. She wanted him to get probation. Even though these jurors sat for 3 months and they saw the body cam footage, they saw the photos of my face, the doctor who worked on me at the emergency room, she testified, my surgeon testified, who did my corrective surgery for my eye socket, 4 police officers testified, the girl that called the police testified. There was so much evidence and footage and like pictures and my testimony, and they saw all of that, and still at the end of the day they were like, poor him, what about him? It was just unreal. And to say like, well, it wasn't that bad, it was just like this constant being so dismissive, and then this rhetoric around me putting the blame on me somehow, that I didn't leave.
Sure.
I was somehow responsible, that I knew what I was doing, that I just couldn't believe. Like, and apparently one of the jurors had also made a comment that I didn't look broken enough when I testified. And I couldn't believe it, because I knew I tried to be so, like when I testified, I just remembered, I knew that my ex and his family and friends were already of the mentality that, or they were trying to create this narrative that I was a liar and that I was exaggerating and that I was vindictive and I was making things up because I wanted to get back at him. And so I was just like so conscious to not at all inflate or exaggerate anything, almost to the point where I think I downplayed certain things or didn't give so much detail, because I really didn't want to look as if I was making it. Like, obviously I wasn't lying about anything, but I didn't want to be perceived as if I was being dramatic or making something up. And I remembered even there was a few times when I started to cry while I was testifying, and like I just tried to swallow my tears, and like I was just so worried about the way I was going to be perceived and as if I wouldn't be believable if I was so emotional, only to find out that, you know, people believed that I looked too strong.
You'll get a low grade now for not emoting enough. And
it was like I looked too together to have been someone who went through all of these things that she's describing. And it was just like, can't win. It's unreal. Like, you just can't win.
You're either going to get hit with overacting, or she didn't look that bad to me. I don't know. Seems like she got through it pretty well.
It's infuriating. Yeah.
I guess so. I put myself in your place, and it's like, you have to go so slowly and so carefully, because if somebody comes off as being interesting, charming, wonderful, gets the door for you, you know, chivalrous, you know, you don't want somebody who is cold. But then again, if you get somebody who is just bringing all the goods, we're bringing them too fast. So yeah, Yeah, I can see where you're just going to take your good old time, which is a very good thing to do.
Yeah, I'm like not even really thinking about anyone else right now.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
I think like I started therapy as soon as my ex was arrested, and I was seeing like two therapists. I still have two therapists, but I was in therapy like three times a week at one point. And I really isolated myself from my friends and family for a while, because I think as much of, like in the beginning when I was going to therapy, obviously a lot of our sessions were about what happened to me and what I went through and all of the like trauma and whatever, which was necessary. But then at a certain point, it's like what my ex did to me really had nothing to do with me. It was his own demons, and it would have, you know, it was like three other girls before me, maybe more. It wasn't about me. In the same way, the reason I picked someone like him was about myself. And at a certain point, I had to address the deeper issue, which was like, why did I pick someone like that? And not in a sense to blame myself, but like, just like realistically, there's something that I need to address, which is why did I stay with him? Why was that comfortable? Like, why was that familiar? Why did that feel like it was okay? And I've really had to work through pretty much ultimately going into things in my childhood and working on like processing and healing from things that I kind of have dissociated from and tried not to think about for a long time. And, you know, when I think about the person that I was when I met my ex, I had no sense of self. I literally, the day before I met my ex, was undiagnosed with bipolar disorder. For 18 straight years of my life, from 4 years old to 22, I was on very heavy prescription medications for disorders I didn't have. And I never got to know who I was, because even though I stopped taking the medication the day before I met him, I then am like now in this very consuming, abusive relationship. So it was really the day that he was arrested 2 years ago was kind of the beginning of my ability to be with myself for the first time. And the legal process just ended like 2 months ago. So I've been so consumed with so much, but like for the first time in my life, I'm finally able to know who I am and learn who I actually am, not on all of these medications. And for me, it's been a really beautiful thing to learn about myself and who I am. And I carried a lot of things about beliefs that I had about myself that weren't mine, that were things other people have projected onto me that I didn't believe, but I would just repeat. They became my beliefs just because I didn't know any better. And so although I went through something that was so horrific, it was personally for me, I think it was necessary for me to snap out of it and do the work to understand that the most important relationship I have is the one with myself. Because when I look at my behavior, even as a child, I was constantly looking for external validation because I craved that so badly, and I couldn't really see how messed up my relationship was with myself. So I know that like one day I will be ready to be in a relationship again, but and my intuition, like I'm very in touch with my intuition now. And like, I always trust my gut. When I met my ex, I didn't have boundaries. I didn't have expectations or red flags to look out for. And now I'm just very much more of an observational person. Like if I'm in a setting with a lot of people, I just am quiet and I just like watch people and what's going on. When somebody feels like a safe person, male or female, platonic or not, I feel that like in my gut, like I already feel whether I like someone or not. And I trust myself. I'm not really interested in dating right now, but I'm pretty like spot on when I feel like someone is not an honest person, or if I don't like their behavior, I just know that like I have a pretty good sense of what my body is telling me, and I'm very in tune with that. So it was very difficult for me to be around men that I didn't know after everything happened. So that's been a struggle, especially in my job, because I work with mostly men. So that was very difficult. But I am not worried about, I don't feel worried about finding myself in that position again, because I'm just in a completely different place from that person. And I wouldn't handle anything the same way that I did. You know, even now when I think back to what happened when I met my ex, even things that were messages that were sent or things that happened on that phone call before we even met in person, if that happened to me now, I would immediately stop talking to that person. I have such high expectations, and yeah, I know that I would never be in that same position again. And I think that obviously not all situations are the same when it comes to like domestic violence, but I think often people who find themselves in those situations, not always, but sometimes, probably have a troubled relationship with themselves, or they grew up neglected or craving external validation. And people that are abusive can tell, like they know, they can feel when you're, you know, oftentimes if you feel inadequate growing up, a lot of people are prone to having like those people pleasing tendencies, no boundaries. I think those kinds of people tend to be targets for abusers. And I think people who have sinister intentions can tell who is a better target to be abused. And that tends to be why they go after people that might have family trouble, people who have divorced parents or one parent, or, you know, who were in foster care or who are a lot younger than them. So I think, but it's harder to find yourself in those situations when you focus on the relationship you have with yourself and you don't put yourself in a position to be dependent on somebody else for the way that you feel about yourself or to support yourself.
That was absolutely great. Just listening to you has just been absolutely amazing. And I've been listening to you as I've been taking notes, especially in the last few minutes when you've been really rolling there about a lot of things. And what I like so much is that you have been in this place for a while, and you're definitely in this place now of having such determination in finding the real you, you know, the real person who's been there all along, but a lot of distractions have been put in your way. You know, a lot of bad information, unfortunate information from the time you were a little kid, you know, way back, but still, you know, foggy way of seeing the world, you know, through medications that were probably really not necessary at all. And I found it so incredibly interesting along the way, because it made me think about myself, about how do I really feel about me? I mean, I was actually going through that while you were saying about that. I mean, how do I really feel? And I probably, even at this point in my life, fall into the trap of when others seem to act positively around me, then I feel pretty good about myself, as opposed to how do I feel about myself? Forget everybody else, you know? So that's so incredibly important. And you talk about predators who are out there, how they look for people who have low self-esteem or people who are coming out of or still in difficulties, whether it's their home life or whatever challenges they're facing. You know, they want somebody that they can really get a hold of, and they can act as if they're the path to something good when they're actually the complete opposite of that. And they're just taking you down a whole different path to hell, you know, and just you just turned out to be so perfect for such an imperfect monster, this guy. So this courage that you're exhibiting coming out of this horrific relationship is so impressive, I have to tell you. I always come away with every one of these conversations I have with people who are domestic violence survivors. I always come away so impressed at the way people like you express yourself, go through all of this, you know, bring it all from the time you were a little kid right up to today. I feel so good that you and I have come together to have this conversation for the benefit of, tell you the truth, both of us, I think, but also anybody who wants to listen. But I mean, your determination is just off the charts. And no matter how you feel about yourself, I am so over the top impressed. So glad I know you. I mean, this is a serious moment for me, an honor to know you and have this time with you. I think that if there's so many things we can take away, but one of the biggest ones is finding out how to make friends with ourselves, I think, and be the best friend for ourselves, and quite frankly, love ourselves. That's my takeaway, at least. I hope a lot of people listening have the same feelings. So Claire, I just want to say, you know, thank you so much for stopping everything and spending a couple hours with me and our listeners eventually. And I hope we can stay in touch somehow whenever it makes sense to speak again or whatever you want to do. I mean, it's totally up to you.
I would love that. Thank you for Good. Having me. I feel honored that you wanted me on your show, and I know that you're doing a lot of good for so many people. So that's, I admire that you've taken something painful for yourself and have turned that into something that is helping other people. It's really beautiful.
Thank you, Claire. I really appreciate this and can't wait to put this together and put it on the air for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This concludes Claire's story. Another innocent person who is taken full advantage of by a horribly toxic animal of a man. His relentless barbarism is on full display. He cannot serve enough time behind bars for what he did and what he would have done. Thank you for listening to the When Dating Hurts podcast. We have been steadily moving up in podcast review rankings based on downloads in the relationships category. That means more and more listeners are getting the kind of advice that can improve lives for victims, survivors, and their families. If you feel we need to hear your story, do not hesitate to email me at BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. That's BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. Hi, it's Bill Mitchell. I'm proud to say the When Dating Hurts podcast is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. To learn more about Evergreen Podcasts or to check out other shows on the Evergreen Network, just visit evergreenpodcasts.com.